You're listening to Admitting Diagnosis, the Journal Watch podcast for February 20th. I'm Joe Elia. We offer news headlines and an interview. Our interview this week examines the use of genetics to set warfarin doses. And don't worry, there are no fruit fly experiments to do or Mendelian tables to construct. Now, a quick stroll through the week's important stories. Links for all may be found at podcasts.jwatch.org. The message may be familiar, but people who eat right, exercise regularly, don't smoke, and drink in moderation face half the risk of stroke of those who do none of those things. And here's a question resolved. For patients with severe coronary artery disease, it's better for them to undergo bypass grafting than stenting with drug-eluting stents. And another fear laid to rest. You don't have to screen all adolescents for dyslipidemia, only those at high risk. But how many of these youngsters are out there in the U.S.? About 200,000, or less than 1% of the adolescent cohort. Some would call it the adolescent horde. Finally, that vexing problem, starting a patient out on warfarin. That's the subject of our interview just ahead. The lead research article in this week's New England Journal of Medicine concerns one of medicine's thorny problems: starting a patient on warfarin and getting the dose right. An international consortium tackled the problem in this way. First, they gathered information on about 5,000 patients who had achieved a stable dose of warfarin. The information gathered included clinical factors such as the indication for treatment and any concomitant medications taken, as well as the final stable dose of warfarin needed to achieve an INR between 2 and 3. Also gathered was genotype information on variants in two genes that affect warfarin metabolism. They used 80% of the cohort to develop two dose prediction models. One was based on clinical data alone, and another was based on clinical data plus the genetic information. The other 20% of the cohort was used as a validation sample, and the researchers used their models to estimate which dose of warfarin the validation sample patients needed to achieve a stable INR. It turned out that the model incorporating the genetic information was much better at predicting the stable dose than the model using simple clinical information. A member of the consortium's writing committee, Dr. Julie Johnson, has kindly agreed to discuss the work. Dr. Johnson is professor and chair of the Department of Pharmacy Practice at the University of Florida College of Pharmacy in Gainesville. She's also a professor of medicine in the medical school there. Thanks for talking with me, Dr. Johnson.
Sure.
I think I've seen my first use of the phrase number needed to genotype in your paper. What are the indications that this measurement will become more common?
So you're right. It was, as we were working on the paper, we thought about how to put that into a context that was somewhat familiar to clinicians. And I think from clinical trials, they're somewhat used to the concept of number needed to treat, so the number of people that you have to treat to derive the benefits that the study looked at. And so we thought that really the same concept might apply as it related to the pharmacogenetic testing. And so, yeah, I think that in the future that may be something that other pharmacogenetics researchers utilize to kind of give clinicians a sense for what the benefit is and how many people do you have to test to derive the potential benefit.
Titrating the dose of warfarin is especially difficult because, as you write, the results of a miscalculation can be catastrophic. How close to clinical application do you think this genetic approach is?
Well, the genetic tests are currently available clinically, so most places are not doing those in their local laboratories, but there are a number of large send-out laboratories that can do these tests. So physicians can order these tests now and can utilize this information. And, in fact, we provide a couple of ways that they could use the information in our dosing algorithm. One is in the New England paper, there's a Microsoft Excel worksheet that they could use to just plug in the information on the patient's genotype along with their age and body size and things like that. And there's also a very user-friendly website, warfarindosing.org, where they can do the same thing. It prompts them for the information that's needed. So, I mean, this really is available for use now for physicians who are interested in doing that. I know that there are other clinicians, though, who feel that they need a little bit more evidence to convince them to use that information. So they want to see that in a randomized trial that using the genetic information is better. And so that trial is actually being launched very shortly by the National Institutes of Health. And so I think, you know, it's for clinicians to decide at this point whether, you know, based on our paper that was in New England and the other papers in the literature, they feel like this information could be useful in helping them to potentially do a better job dosing their warfarin patients, or if they want to, you know, wait until the clinical trial is completed, which will probably be a couple years.
There were no patients whose dosages were, or whose doses were actually calculated by the algorithm. This was a group
right.
of 5,000 patients with stable INRs, and so you used 80% of the sample to estimate or to develop these algorithms, and then use the other 20% to apply those algorithms to, and say, all right, so let's see if we can estimate what their final dose was. Is that right?
Yeah. So all of these patients were, their warfarin dose was determined really in a traditional way. And once we knew their warfarin dose, we had their genotype, we had their other important clinical information. That's then how we built this clinical and pharmacogenetic algorithm with that information on these 5,000-plus individuals. And then in that 20%, as you mentioned, we said, okay, let's pretend we were going to use the genetic information to dose them. And so we plugged in that information. We plugged in their information into the equation and said, okay, well, it just so happens we really know what dose they needed and how close were those.
Uh-huh.
And so, yeah, so there have been smaller studies that have used algorithms like this to actually determine a patient's warfarin dose. So there is some prospective evidence in the literature that really does suggest that it is beneficial. These have really been very, very small studies. And what was in many ways very unique about ours was not only this algorithm we developed, but really the size of the cohort and the diversity. So we had participants from 9 different countries, 4 continents, and so we really have a very broad racial and ethnic diversity that has not been approached in any of the literature on warfarin to date.
The editorial talks of outliers, and
uh-huh.
but the outliers in your sample actually were, you know, those people who required finally less than 21 milligrams per week and 49 milligrams per week or more. So the people in the middle of those extremes, they constituted about 50% of the sample. The other 50% were these outliers, weren't they?
Yeah, that's correct. And I've actually, you know, several people yesterday when they read the paper and read the editorial didn't really like the use of that term outlier, because to a lot of people, outlier means a single person who's sort of way off from the rest of the group.
Yeah.
And so to a lot of people, that term maybe isn't quite the right term. I think the term you used is really the better one. It's the people at the dose extremes, or the people at the, you know, at the two tails of the dose distribution. And you're right. It was nearly 50% of the cohort that was in those two tails. So I understand, you know, what they were getting at in the editorial, but I do think that the term outlier, the way they were using it, is different than what a lot of people think of when they hear the word outlier.
The people who were, as they were called, outliers, were the people who got the most benefit from the use of genetic information and calculating the dose. Is that right?
Yeah. So basically, you know, one of our reference points, if you will, was 5 milligrams a day, because it really seems that the vast majority of patients in this country, at least, are started on 5 milligrams a day of warfarin. And so, and we really felt that if someone, in fact, needed 3 or less and got started on 5, that represents a pretty significant overdose.
Yeah.
And so potential, real potential risk for them. of bleeding while you figure out that, you know, five really is too much for them. And likewise for the people who require seven or four a day, then, you know, similarly, the 5 milligrams is, you know, really a pretty substantial underdose for those people. And
yes.
So that's how we really picked those boundaries, if you will, based on our clinical impressions that if those are the doses they need, five is really, you know, a little bit too far off.
Yeah, is it fair to say, though, that so you used three algorithms? You used the traditional 5 milligrams, and then they used the clinical information, and then you used the clinical plus the genetic information. And the 5 milligram approach did worst.
Yeah, absolutely. Much worse even than when you just take into account the clinical information.
So do you think people should stop using that 5 milligram starting dose and start adopting some of these other algorithms that are out there, even if they don't include genetic information?
I think our data would definitely suggest that, you know, even if you're not ready to embrace the genetic testing, that at a minimum, you really ought to be using the patient-specific information that the patient is giving you.
Yeah.
And so, you know, their age, their body size, their interacting drugs. I mean, we know that those are important determinants of warfarin dose. And so, I think that the main theme of this paper really is the pharmacogenetics. But I think another message really is that, you know, even if you're not ready to do pharmacogenetics, that we can probably do much better for these patients by using this clinical algorithm than just by, sort of starting everybody on 5 milligrams and just working from there.
Yeah. The article says there's more work needed before broad adoption of the genetic algorithm. For instance, you say that the genetic information that's gathered in the algorithm you used concerns mainly sensitivity to warfarin. But there are genes that govern warfarin resistance. So is that the next step in your research, is to find what those genes are?
Yes. In fact, our consortium is continuing our work, and we have an effort ongoing now that really is focused on trying to discover those genes that might be associated with very high dose requirements. And so what we found is that our algorithm was pretty good at predicting doses up to 8 or 9 milligrams a day. But much above that, it just doesn't really work very well. And the reason for that is that we really haven't identified yet genetic variants that predict someone's requirement for that very high dose. And so a number of groups who are in the Warfarin Consortium are continuing our work together to try to identify those genetic variants might be that cause people. I mean, we have a pretty good idea now what causes them to require lower doses, and so we're hoping we can also discover the genes that, make people require 10, 12, 15 milligrams a day. So, we still do have a lot of work to do.
But there aren't too many of those people. Those would be the true outliers, wouldn't they?
Yeah, those are definitely at the upper extreme, and I can't remember off the top of my head what percent of our population required 10 milligrams or more. I mean, it was a very small percent, for sure. So we really are capturing the vast majority in this more, you know, normal range, which I say, you know, I would say the more normal range is probably in the 1.5 to 10 milligrams a day. And the algorithms do pretty well in that range.
Uh-huh. And what other drugs might benefit from knowing the patient's genetic makeup? Are there other drugs besides warfarin that seem good targets for this approach?
Yeah, there are. There actually have been a number of sort of exciting findings just this year, as well as some that we've sort of understood for a while. Probably the latest one to come onto the scene is clopidogrel, which is an antiplatelet drug, so, you know, somewhat related in terms of the settings in which you would use also warfarin. And the case in clopidogrel is also involves a drug metabolizing enzyme. And in this case, clopidogrel is not active. It has to be broken down in the liver to the active form, and some people can't do that. So that's one example where it looks like there are pretty big differences. Several cancer drugs, we have had an understanding for a relative long period of time of some benefits. So I think warfarin is certainly not the first one, but I think warfarin has drawn a lot of attention because a lot of our examples up until warfarin were more specialized drugs. And so, a lot of cancer drugs or drugs that would really be used only by one, subspecialty physician group. I mean, warfarin is used by so many different types of patients, which means that so many different types of physicians have to prescribe warfarin. And so I think from that perspective, it's sort of new and interesting because it's really so broadly used.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank you, Dr. Julie Johnson, for your time with us this morning and for braving a cell phone conversation.
Sure, I appreciate the opportunity.
With this edition of Admitting Diagnosis, we've changed the news format from brief to caricature-like. The change is designed to get you to the interview faster, and of course, you can always get the details you need by going to podcasts.jwatch.org. Let me know what you think. Have a great week of healing. If you want to comment or complain, call 617-440-4374 and leave a message. Our executive producer is Ador Yano, and I'm Joe Elia, in charge of mutations. We'll see you next week. Thanks for listening to Admitting Diagnosis.